From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, it's a decision day for the Supreme Court. One decision on gerrymandering that isn't as enlightening as many had hoped, and an interesting footnote buried in a 7-2 decision that could signal a major shift in the court's thinking. We'll break it all down with our legal analyst. Also today, hundreds gather at the Statehouse for a hearing on a bill that would expand access to abortion. We'll hear from State Senate President Karen Spilka.
I definitely understand that this is not an easy issue. It is a very emotional issue.
And what's the business impact of the issues on the MBTA?
We're in a state of emergency. I was incredibly discouraged by Governor Baker's reaction. Okay, we might be on the right path, but if we get there in 50 or 100 years, it doesn't matter.
We'll take your calls next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. With just 2 weeks left in the Supreme Court term, there are a number of high-profile cases left to be decided. And today, the court released four decisions, including one of three gerrymandering cases it heard arguments for this session. For more on what we got today and what's still pending, we're joined by Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge, a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be here.
So, Judge, as I mentioned, there are a few highly anticipated issues that we're expecting the court to rule on. One of those is gerrymandering. While we did get a gerrymandering decision today, it might not have been the major news we were hoping for. The Virginia gerrymandering case was tossed out, basically because it was a challenge that was only brought by the State House of Representatives. So was this decision more of a whimper than a bang, or is there something we can glean from this as we look to the other two gerrymandering decisions still left to be released?
It's hard to say because this was really a very technical decision. Virginia statutes authorize the Attorney General to bring this kind of challenge, not members of the House of Representatives. So it's a very technical standing issue. It could be that, you know, this is a court that is trying to move things along without there being sort of major fights, and it may be that they know two important cases are coming down the line, so it's costless to toss this out. I don't think it forecasts anything at all.
Speaking of the two important cases that are still pending, North Carolina and Maryland, there's been some new evidence introduced since the Supreme Court heard the arguments. Specifically, these are files from the now deceased Republican strategist Thomas Hoffler. And they could potentially apply to both the gerrymandering cases, but also the case involving a citizenship question on the census. What is the procedure when new evidence is introduced after arguments have been heard? Can it affect the court's decision at this point?
It doesn't come before back to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court doesn't have a procedure to reopen a record, or not an ordinary procedure to reopen a record. It's what you need to do here. But depending upon what happens in the Supreme Court, the plaintiffs could go back in the lower court and try to seek to reopen if the case is dismissed based on newly discovered evidence. And particularly if this is evidence that they should have gotten, but the defendants were somehow remiss in providing it, there may be a way to reopen it. But that would be at the lower court level. That's not a Supreme Court, something that the Supreme Court does. The Supreme Court deals typically with a closed record. Now, the question is whether the judges, knowing what's out there from, you know, being people in the world and reading the newspapers, whether that'll affect how they'll decide it, even though it's not actually before
Interesting.
Them.
So it could still affect their minds or the way they think about it, even though
right.
it's
I
not
mean,
admitted.
You know, whether they shut the door firmly or whether they leave it open, there's an interesting question in the census case about the legitimacy of evidence of intent. And so depending upon what they say, they could make a subsequent motion for new evidence at the trial level more or less likely.
So, Judge Gertner, while we were watching for these high-profile things, there was this interesting footnote in another case today. There was a decision in a case involving double jeopardy, and Justice Clarence Thomas wrote a concurring opinion. And again, he took the opportunity to argue against stare decisis, writing in part, quote, "By applying demonstrably erroneous precedent instead of the relevant law's text, as the court is particularly prone to do when expanding federal power or crafting new individual rights, the court exercises force and will, two attributes the people did not give it." Justice Thomas also argued against stare decisis in a decision earlier this year in which the court overturned a decision from 1979. Do you have a reaction to Thomas's take on the importance or lack thereof of precedent in this ruling today?
Justice Thomas now knows that there are at least two other members of the court who are, for want of a better word, actively seeking to be critical of previous precedent, of precedent. In other words, when he was alone, even Justice Scalia was not someone who would deal with, who would upend established precedent. Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Gorsuch are not in that category. Though I don't know whether they have signed on to the following, there is literature with the Federalist Society that says, for example, that a judge that fails to overturn legislation when the Constitution suggests that it should is being an activist judge. Likewise, there's literature, mostly the Federalist Society literature, about how the court should be active in reevaluating old established precedent.
Judge Gertner, so just to clarify for our listeners, the Federalist Society is a fairly conservative legal organization that's had some influence, at least arguably, on the most recent Supreme Court picks. Is that correct?
Right. That's right. And the Federalist Society literature deals with precedent very much in the way that Justice Thomas did, which is, you know, there's nothing special about it if it flies in the face of good law or what the law should be. And that's an overstatement, but it's something along that line. And now what Thomas has is Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, whom he knows are aligned with him on the approach to precedent. And the case that is in the sights of these judges is, of course, Roe v. Wade.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So experts have been predicting that this court would be extremely partisan. And I think when we get to Roe v. Wade, we might see something there. With conservative justices holding a 5-4 majority, there is an opportunity to kind of group up. But that hasn't exactly played out so far the way we thought it might. Let me give you a couple of examples. In the Virginia gerrymandering case, Bader Ginsburg, Thomas, Sotomayor, Kagan, and Gorsuch were on one side, with the dissent being Alito, Roberts, Breyer, and Kavanaugh. And then on the uranium decision, Roberts led the dissent but was joined by both Breyer and Alito. So are we seeing some strange bedfellows, and does this augur that maybe this isn't going to be as partisan a court as people thought?
No, it doesn't augur that. It augurs that in cases that are technical, that admit of a technical resolution, the court will split in unusual ways. But that doesn't necessarily mean that either in the gerrymandering case in Roe v. Wade or in some of the cases that are coming down the line that you won't see the usual alignment. In other words, the Virginia case was a technical decision. You know, this person had a right to sue, this person didn't. The uranium decision was also arguably technical, and so the usual alignments don't apply. But I don't think it doesn't mean that on the issues that divide our country, those kinds of fault lines, that you won't see a partisan court.
So watch this space on that question.
Right.
Before we move on from the Supreme Court, just one more question. There are some pretty major cases that we expect to get decisions on before the end of the term, later this month. What do you have your eye on?
I think the North Carolina and Maryland gerrymandering cases are critical. It's an area where the court usually doesn't, it's a space the court doesn't usually enter because it's a partisan space, and the argument is that when one partisan goes so far as to distort the process, it raises a constitutional question. So what they do in those cases, I think, will really be telling. I think that's what we need to look for. And it also would forecast, it would have impact on elections going forward. So that's really, I think, an extraordinary case.
Judge Gertner, I'm going to shift gears now. While we've got you, I'd like to ask you at least one or two questions about recent Supreme Judicial Court decisions here in Massachusetts. First of all, the SJC recently ruled that law enforcement has to have a warrant to do what's called pinging an individual's cell phone location, to essentially find the location of that individual. But it did carve out an exemption if there are exigent circumstances, such as danger to the public, threat of suspect fleeing. What do you make of that ruling, and is it important?
It is important. It's really part of all courts' efforts to engage with the new technology. If we restricted the Fourth Amendment, the amendment that requires a warrant, you know, to situations in which police knock down the doors to your home, then it would essentially become irrelevant in the modern world. The enterprise is to say, look at this technology. Is it the functional equivalent of those kinds of intrusions? And that's what the Supreme Court has done with respect to, you know, devices that you put under cars to figure out where they are going, GPS devices under a car, and other kinds of things. It's saying, are they the functional equivalent of the kinds of privacy incursions that the Constitution was designed to restrict?
So, Judge Gertner, we've seen some interesting examples of the various branches of government struggling with how to stay abreast of and handle new technologies. As a retired federal judge, can you give us a little peek behind the curtain? How hard is it for a judge to apply old laws to new technologies as
well,
they emerge?
That's an interesting question. On the one hand, apropos of your question about precedent, it's easy because there is no precedent. You're so clearly dealing with a new situation and the application of old laws to a new situation. At the same time, the question of how you do it is critical. In some cases, you know, there's a split between those who believe that the Constitution, state and federal, has to be interpreted in the way that it would have been at the time of the drafting. And if that's the model, then it's very difficult to make it up to date.
Mm-hmm.
So it's difficult to sort of figure out what the functional equivalent of breaking down the door without a warrant is. I also found it was interesting. I mean, you understand that judges tend to be older and may not necessarily be in tune with the new technology. There was famously a wonderful moment when the Supreme Court was dealing with a GPS device under a car that Justice Roberts leaned over the bench and said, "You mean they could do this to me?"
Interesting.
And it was extraordinary. It was like all of a sudden the new technology and its impact on all of us became clear, and the court said that required a warrant. That was with respect to GPS devices on the bottom of cars. This is related. The Supreme Court, the SJC, has been particularly careful and sort of ahead of the field with respect to the constitutional implications of new technology. So this pinging decision doesn't surprise me.
Well, that's Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR legal analyst. Judge Gertner, thanks as always for your time with Radio Boston.
Thanks.
All right. Stay tuned for more. Coming up, we check in with Massachusetts Senate President Karen Spilka. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
We know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. A packed hearing continues at the State House this hour over a bill that would remove limits on abortion in Massachusetts. Hundreds of pro-life and pro-choice advocates are in attendance. The bill, or the Roe Act, would let women get an abortion after 24 weeks of pregnancy in cases of fatal fetal anomalies. It would also get rid of parental consent requirements for teenagers seeking an abortion. We spoke with Senate President Karen Spilka just before the hearing began about what she expects to happen today.
I first and foremost want to say and put it on the record that the Senate will always protect access to women's reproductive health care, and a woman's right to choose. That's really important to start out with. But the Roe Act is being heard today. I anticipate a lot of stakeholders, public will testify, many people bringing personal testimony to the committee, and that's exactly how the legislative process is supposed to work. So I believe it'll probably be a long committee hearing, and then the committee will report it out, and we'll refine and we'll debate the bill based on what we hear.
What is the difference between what will be legal after 24 weeks under the new bill specifically than under the current law?
Right now, after 24 weeks, the only reason that a woman could have an abortion is for the woman's health is at risk. This would add a second category so that if there is a fatal fetal abnormality, then that the pregnancy could be terminated as well.
What are the couple of other most important provisions as you see them, and could you explain them for our listeners a little, please?
Well, right now, for minors, women under 18 years of age, they need either the parental consent or a process called a judicial bypass where they can go to a judge and get a judicial bypass if they can't discuss this with their parent or legal guardian. This would remove the consent piece so that a woman under 18 years of age could have an abortion as well.
Can you imagine and understand that there will be parents who will be really concerned about the idea of children so young pursuing abortions without parental consent? Can you understand why that would be an emotional issue for parents and maybe even individual legislators? And what do you have to say to that concern? How do we address that as we go through considering this act?
I definitely understand that the possibility of removing consent could be incredibly difficult, controversial, painful for parents and legal guardians. This is not an easy issue. It is a very emotional issue. And the Senate wants to hear, and that's one reason why the legislative process is so important. And the hearing today, to hear stakeholders, to have the public testify, as I said earlier, to let people share their personal stories, their personal testimony to the committee, and then we go back in the Senate and we discuss all of that, and so we will see what the final bill will have.
The chairman of the Massachusetts Republican State Committee, Jim Lyons, has called this bill or says that it promotes infanticide. How would you respond to that?
I would say this bill does no such thing. This is when there is a clear fetal abnormality that the fetus is not growing, the fetus has no brain. The doctor can tell now, technology and all the medical equipment can tell when a fetus is no longer growing.
So there's been some reporting that this legislation removes instructions to physicians regarding responsibilities toward a fetus after the abortion, should it be potentially viable. I think I hear you saying you don't see a likelihood of that being a circumstance. If it were...
Right. I mean, if the fetus, in effect, an example would be that the brain has stopped growing or something, then the fetus is deemed not viable. And again, the way that the bill is written now will, if it comes to the floor, it will be changed along the process. It'll be changed probably out of committee. It'll go to the House or the Senate. It'll be changed in either branch. So, and then there's the conference committee. So there's a lot of room for clarification. And this is early in the process.
So Governor Baker has said that he supports the state's current abortion laws, which, as you noted, are more restrictive for abortions that are allowed after 24 weeks. This expansion is a big fight playing out in the State House today. But if the governor's not on board, what will that mean for the future of a bill like this?
Well, again, we'll have to see what the final bill does. So, I don't know what the governor's position will be on any final bill.
We are talking to Senate President Karen Spilka. I'm going to move on to education funding now, President Spilka. There's a new report from the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center today that finds that state lawmakers need to address a $1 billion gap between two bills focused on overhauling state education funding. $1 billion is a big gap. Does that concern you?
Well, again, we have several bills. I know the study that you're referring to that came out refers to two bills. There are several bills that are being considered by the Education Committee. So this still is in the process, but I am very hopeful and hope that we will see a final bill on the governor's desk by the end of this year.
So right now, the bill that is endorsed by the governor is $1 billion below the one that's endorsed by the Mass Teachers Association and Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. That second bill, the higher priced one, called the Promise Act, was proposed in part by Senator Sonia Chang-Diaz. The report called it a more aggressive bill. Here's Colin Jones, an analyst for the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center.
We do have to be honest, though, because a more generous approach is going to mean that the state is going to have to come up with this revenue to support that plan. And so we don't want to forget that aspect of it, that if you do a bigger and bolder reform, you also need to figure out how to have adequate, steady revenue to pay for it.
President Spilka, of those two plans, which do you think makes the most sense for Massachusetts?
There are more than two plans before the committee, so I think the committee is looking at all of it and trying to reach consensus.
Okay, let's shift gears again. There was a red line train, as you know, that derailed last week, and a green line train the previous weekend, which caused massive delays, and the repairs are still ongoing. We know that commuters have faced continued delays. We're having a conversation on our show today about the funding for the MBTA. Do you think the state should invest more?
I think that this is something that the governor is looking a lot at, whether or not the state should invest more in the MBTA. In general, I believe that we need to invest more in our transportation infrastructure across the state. A few weeks ago, we were deemed to be number one in the country in congestion and traffic. We need to change that, and we need to take action. So that's why I have a transportation working group looking at what do we need to do and how can we pay for it.
Okay, and our last little bit of time, President Spilka, I don't want to lose you without just asking you about your broader agenda. We last spoke at the very beginning of the new year, and you laid out your biggest priorities then as education funding, healthcare, economic advancement fueled by technology and innovation, transportation. What do you view as your biggest accomplishment so far this year?
I believe my biggest accomplishment is starting out the year having a very strong Senate. I'm very proud of the down payment on education funding reform in the Senate budget. We took a huge step forward in funding the Foundation Budget Review Commission's recommendations more than ever before in the history of Massachusetts. We've already passed Lift the Cap on Kids and Gender X and banned conversion therapy and distracted driving, but we're already working hard on, as I said, education, transportation, climate change, mental health, having a transformative approach. We're looking at housing, creating more affordable housing across the state, and we are working to move Massachusetts forward.
That's Senate President Karen Spilka. Thanks for giving us your time today.
Thank you so much. Have a terrific day.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It was another slow commute into the city this morning as the MBTA's red line operated on a reduced level following last week's derailment. Investigators have yet to determine the cause of the derailment, but ongoing delays and problems on the T have led to much frustration among commuters, T riders, drivers, business leaders, and public figures. Listeners, we want to hear from you for the rest of the hour on this. What was your commute like this morning on the MBTA and on the roads? Are we at a transit tipping point? How have the recent MBTA disruptions impacted your family, your work, your businesses, your life? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can send us a tweet. We're at Radio Boston. One of the frustrated public officials is Andrea Campbell, Boston City Council president. We spoke with her this afternoon and began with the impact that continued problems at the T and our crumbling infrastructure are having on her constituents.
I mean, it's major. And I think, like you said, you know, it's a crumbling infrastructure. When you think about the city of Boston being a world-class city, it is imperative that our transportation system reflect that. I have a district largely Mattapan and Dorchester, a little bit of Jamaica Plain and Rosendale, where folks continually use the T to get to work. Many of the workers in my district are low-wage workers who rely solely on the T to get to their jobs, to bring their children to daycare. So the economic impact is great when the T isn't working. In addition, for folks to be able to get downtown or to participate in other cultural events and for it not to work or not work frequently on the weekends is a major issue as well. And so it's a major connectivity issue. The list is long and we have to get this right.
So I really hear the sort of the quality of life implications as well for your residents. And I have been thinking, we and others have done a lot of reporting over the last couple of weeks since the derailments especially, but are there impacts that you're hearing about from your constituents that haven't been reported on, that haven't been visible to the broader community who may not be taking the T every day or who are really focused on their own inconveniences?
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, when one of the reporters I was talking to asked me about, you know, is this a tipping point, the recent derailment for the Red Line? And I said, no, there have been many tipping points. Just that weekend, I personally had relatives in town for a major family celebration, and we had to go and pick them up at JFK because the T had shut down. If you wanted and had the luxury of taking a Lyft or Uber or some other ride-sharing company, the rates were peaked, and so it was extremely expensive. Many of those folks could not afford that. The lines were long, and so it's a major inconvenience. It absolutely is a quality of life issue. It's an economic issue. It's also a public safety issue. The fact that all of these folks have to get off of a train and then get on the streets, creating more cars, more traffic, more congestion. We know that also can create public safety issues.
So we're beyond a breaking point now and kind of into more crisis place.
That's right. We've been beyond a breaking point for years. And it requires not only increased investment in getting this right, but the increased investment is not just to throw money at the problem. It's to make sure that all of the changes we agree need to happen to improve our transit system, that it happens in a timely manner. People cannot wait 2 years, 3 years, 5 years down the line for a system that reflects the level of economic opportunity that happens in the city of Boston and in the greater Boston area. The ability to connect our neighborhoods in the city is so vital. We want people to be connected to one another. We want folks to be connected to their family members outside of the city of Boston. Of course, this includes the commuter rail. And as taxpaying citizens, we deserve a system that works for us.
We are speaking with City Council President Andrea Campbell. Councilor, you tweeted last week, for our governor not to understand that it requires deeper financial investment so that these changes can go into effect faster is a little bit baffling. Are you saying MBTA improvements under Governor Baker just haven't happened fast enough?
That's exactly right. When it comes to the T and the MBTA, the administration has to do better and requires their leadership to exercise the political will and the political courage to not only put forth deeper financial investments, but to also make these changes faster. And for them to continue to take this idea that we need deeper financial investment off the table is baffling to me. I don't understand it. And the last thing we want, of course, is to put the burden, the financial burden, on the riders. This is on us to get it right and to think about either pulling at existing resources in our budget or thinking about new revenue streams in order to get this right.
I want to come back to that point you just made in a minute, but just quickly, doubling back, you've said a couple of times in your last couple comments here, you've talked about deeper investment and more investment. You know, the administration does regularly cite work with the control board, the winterization plan following the 2015 snowstorms, the $8 billion setup for capital spending on the MBTA. So they would argue they're making investments. What would you say to that?
It's clearly not enough. For folks to continue to suffer from derailments for bus services, and we haven't been talking about our buses. A lot of my residents depend on buses because in many parts of my district, there are transportation deserts, so they have to walk to get to a bus route. They're not happening quicker and fast enough. They don't get folks to their location in a timely manner. So in order for these plans to happen, I think it requires more investment, more engagement, and for folks to actually feel these impacts when they get on our train.
Councillor, transportation deserts are an equity issue, and you've made a couple of other comments that refer to equity. So I'd like to talk about that a little bit more specifically. You joined a petition led by Councillor Michelle Wu that opposes next month's planned fare increase. And actually, Mayor Marty Walsh tweeted just this morning that he thinks the increase should be delayed until the red line is fixed. Councillor Wu has actually gone even further and has called for making the system free. So two questions for you. Sure. First, should we make it free? And also, how else can the system be more equitable for Boston's residents?
Equity is so important to me. I represent a district that has long been under-resourced and underserved for a really long time. You see the gaps when it comes to folks who live in my district, predominantly a district of color, in different pockets, some of the poorest in the city of Boston. My residents put me in this role to always name those inequities, but then to do something about it. And particularly when it comes to the T, the bus service is not the greatest in my district or doesn't even exist in certain pockets of my district. You have the Fairmount line, which is a great new addition to my district, but doesn't run frequently enough. People can't use their Charlie cards on the actual train. It is not very user-friendly. So there's a lot more work to do. And when we look at issues through an equity lens, it is incumbent upon us to respond to certain areas and certain districts faster. In terms of whether or not the T should be free or not, I think that's an issue for the state to decide. For me, what's most important is I'm on the local side. I want to do what's within my power and control, and that is pushing for the T, of course, to fix the system as it exists now, to do better, not to do it on the backs of our residents. So I'm absolutely against the fare hikes. I was happy to see the mayor, you know, join us in that effort this morning. I think it's critical. And not just, you know, wait till the red line is fixed. The orange line is also facing issues. We have to do better in connecting the blue line residents to other transit systems. So there's so many things we have to do on the T side. I'm pushing for more transit and to be better, more buses to work, to show up on time, to have more buses in the first place, and to also talk about how we get more dedicated bus lanes in the community. Everything has to be on the table in terms of improving our T system for our residents.
Boston City Council President Andrea Campbell, that's a huge agenda. There's a lot there, and the burden of it, I think, can sound a little overwhelming. So for our listeners today who maybe have been on a commuting odyssey this past couple of weeks, and for whom the T is the only option, what is your message to them?
I say, you know, we lead when we have a plan. And right now, the plan for me involves a few things. One is making sure that the T is investing in the MBTA as it should. And then separately, as a city of Boston elected, there are structural changes we need to make to our streets. So we have speeding cars, traffic congestion. We need speed humps. We need all of that. I'm pushing for investments on the local side, pushing for ways to increase our ridership on bikes and on the T. It all works together. And the plan requires that we not only focus on the T, but we focus on these other city issues where we have the authority and need to move faster as well. It goes hand in hand. And I want my residents in particular and those who ride the red line to know that I feel their pain and frustration. The majority of my team take the T. It takes them sometimes a really long time to get to work, and we're not letting this issue go.
That's Boston City Council President Andrea Campbell. Thanks so much for joining Radio Boston.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Joining us now in the studio are two women who know a lot about the business impacts of our transit woes. C.A. Webb is president of the Kendall Square Association. C.A., welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
And also with us is Carolyn Ryan, senior vice president of policy and research at the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce. Welcome back to you as well, Carolyn.
Thank you.
Listeners, call us. We want to hear from you. What was your commute like today? Tell us what you think about whether we're at a transit tipping point. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or tweet at us. We're at Radio Boston. So I'm going to start by asking you both, how was your commute today? And how has it been in the last few days since the derailment? Go ahead, CA.
My commute is pretty embarrassing. I live near Harvard Square. My typical commute is I drop my children, I walk to the Harvard T, go two stops to Kendall Square. It's a great way to start the day.
That doesn't sound embarrassing. That sounds awesome.
Well, when it works. But I couldn't afford to be late this morning, so guess what I did?
What?
I drove.
Oh, from Harvard Square?
From Harvard Square to Kendall Square.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
It's not the way it should be.
Yeah. Carolyn?
I'm a bus rider, and believe it or not, the mornings have been pretty good the last week. The evening commute home has been pretty difficult because all of the people that are driving now because of the red line derailment, you're feeling that, especially when you are trying to get past South Station, the surface roads there. So I would say, fingers crossed, this afternoon goes a little better than it has for the last week.
Yeah. Now, Carolyn, we just heard from City Council President Andrea Campbell. What was your reaction from what you heard from her?
You know, I think she hit the nail on the head on a lot of the things she talked about. There's certainly a level of impatience out there with people and definitely frustration. And I think it's all it all makes a ton of sense. I think the challenge is, you know, a lot of the issues that all employers are facing, the T is facing as an employer. So we have less than 3% unemployment, which means hiring bodies can be difficult. So to get all of these projects done, you need bodies. There's also just the general construction you see around Boston. So all of the sort of tradespeople and things that normally might be able to help execute a T project are off doing other construction projects. So this capacity issue is a real serious issue. And I think we've got to start paying more attention to that, you know, as a sort of community on how we solve that problem.
So that's the good news, bad news of the economy piece
right.
of this.
Right.
CA, what else? What would you react to?
I thought Council President Campbell made some great points. I think she's right. This is not a red line problem. This is a systems failure. We have reached a crisis point. We're in a state of emergency, and we have to act now. I loved her emphasis on doing what's in her sphere of power and control, because every single Massachusetts citizen can do that. We've been doing that in Kendall Square for some time.
How? Give us an example.
So we have a group. We partnered with the City of Cambridge, and for 3 years, we studied the transportation problem, because this is not a new problem. This is what the leading problem our employers have been talking about for a decade. They've been very concerned about underinvestment in the system and what they're hearing from their people every morning. So for 3 years, we studied it and we came together with a series of recommendations. We'll be releasing this publicly in a couple of weeks, but we covered everything. We looked at the fact that the MBTA hasn't brought a new bus route into Kendall Square in 20 years, a generation, right? Kendall Square is fundamentally a different place than it was 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We looked at bus routes. We looked at rail. We looked at the Grand Junction, which will connect Boston to Cambridge in a multimodal way. And we have solutions and we want to partner. We want to partner with the state, with our legislators, with MassDOT, and with the MBTA to create a better future for all of us.
I think we'll be able to come back a little later, too, to this idea of bold planning for our larger transportation issues. The callers are coming in, so let's take one. Let's talk to John from Weston. John, what did you call in to talk about?
Thanks. I just think our entire perspective on our public transportation system is way too timid. We've just returned from a trip to Vienna, where it is networked with trams, buses, trains, and no one's driving. There are parking places all over. Trams come every 3 to 5 minutes. There are seats. It's available. They're clean. And everyone's doing it. There's no need for parking garages anymore.
CA, go ahead.
I hear you, John. I just got back from Oslo and had exactly the same reaction. They've largely gotten rid of single passenger vehicles in their city center. They have extraordinary, fast, frequent, reliable transit. You know, the reality is we're competing in a global economy. Yes, we have companies like Akamai and Kendall Square that were born here and have strategically decided this is where they want to keep growing. We also have companies like Takeda that are headquartered in Tokyo, Sanofi in Paris. You know, companies that this is a secondary headquarters for them. And guess what? If it's too hard to do business in Massachusetts, they'll go somewhere else.
So, Carolyn, it sounds like we're a far cry from at least some other communities around the world who have really made huge investments. Mm-hmm. What are you hearing from businesses around Boston about how they're thinking about the MBTA, how they're thinking about public transit, transportation in Boston?
So there's the frustration that everybody's talked about. It's their employees can't get to work. That has impacts both for work and outside of work. We did a study about a year ago about the economic impacts of congestion. So that was just looking at people who are driving. And it's close to $2.5 billion a year, whether that's lost wages or lost productivity. So that's real economic impact.
You also came up with a number of sort of average loss per worker, which I found quite striking. It was $1,300 a year per worker?
That's right. And that's just for the average wage in the state. So for some workers, it's much higher than that.
That's kind of shocking. I mean, I mean, the $2.4 billion number is a big number, but mm-hmm. I think people can really identify with $1,300 gone out of their pocket.
Right.
So what do we do? Well, actually, let's wait, because if we go straight to solutions, we won't have other exciting things to talk about. And we've got some callers we're going to want to get to in a few minutes. Let me ask, CA, Kendall Square is a hub of business. It's, you know, prides itself on growth and innovation. How much of that can be attributed to access to public transit up until now?
Kendall Square would not have developed in the way that it has without MIT anchoring it and without that T-stop there.
So you put it on par with MIT?
Absolutely.
That's interesting.
Absolutely. 41% of our people take transit to work every day. The number of drivers coming into Kendall Square has stayed flat for 20 years because our employers recognize that to leverage what we have, this mm-hmm. very dense urban district, there isn't enough parking. Parking is not a productive use of our key urban spaces. And so we're not building more parking garages. We're building more labs, more offices, more places to produce technological breakthroughs, scientific discoveries, and economic outputs.
Okay.
And so we need transit to get our people there to do those things.
Listeners, please keep calling. It's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Benishay from downtown Boston is calling. Benishay, let us know what's on your mind.
Yes. Hi. How are you? So, yes, I was just, I'm in downtown, and I was, I don't take the train anymore because this issue has been going on for many, many years. And I would prefer to take the train to get a book and read, but I can't get to work because of all this nonsense situation. It's been going on since I was in college, and that's a long time ago. Now I take my car, and no matter what time of the day, it doesn't matter what time. It could be right now, 3 something in the afternoon, and I'm stuck in the traffic. And the only time I'm not stuck in the traffic is 7 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday. So there is something really major. This is really a major crisis in Boston.
Benishay, I love the horn honking in the background for emphasis.
Thank you. This has become our lives. And there's all these like chit-chat, talking to this one, talking to this. It's just nonsense. Absolute nonsense. Something's got to get done.
Okay, Benishay, let me take it from there. I'm going to turn it over to Carolyn now, because Benishay's talking about both the urgency to get something done, but also what I would call quality of life. Mm-hmm. And you talked about challenges in recruiting workers. How will this affect our ability to continue to grow as an economy when the transportation system affects quality of life and frustrates our workers the way we heard Benishay frustrated in her call?
Well, you see, even just from that call, it's already affecting the decisions people make. So the frustration with transit has led her to drive. Some of the things that we talk about is how to use pricing to try and incentivize different types of behaviors. So one of those behaviors you want to try and incentivize is to get people out of their cars and onto public transportation. The challenge is our public transportation system right now is not always a viable option. It's not reliable enough. And for commuter rail service, a lot of people would tell you it's not frequent enough. So people are making choices as far as where they live to a degree where they work. And that's going to start to affect businesses choosing to come into the city, because if the workers don't want to be there, they're not going to want to be there either.
Okay, so CA, you talked about parking a minute ago, and Carolyn, you talked about getting people out of their cars and into public transit. Jim Aloisi, a former state transportation secretary, tweeted recently, you know, kind of in the wake of this crisis, if you can afford daily $20 to $100 Uber trips, there's no transportation crisis. If you have subsidized parking, there's no transportation crisis. If you can't afford Uber, or if your employer doesn't subsidize your downtown parking space, believe me, there's a transportation crisis. So what about this idea that by subsidizing parking, employers are actually exacerbating, transit and congestion problems? CA?
Absolutely. I mean, that's something we're diving into with our employers in Kendall Square. MIT has done some really interesting work where they have shifted from a monthly charge to a daily charge for their faculty, staff, and students that park there. And they're seeing behavioral change. They're seeing that people think differently when they spend on parking on a daily basis versus a monthly, even when it's capped at the same rate, right? They saw a 9% reduction in people driving into work. Now, they coupled that with giving everyone a free T-pass. Not all employers do that, though I would argue that the state should facilitate enabling that. Mm-hmm. That's a great spend of our public dollars to ease the system. I thought Beneche's points were great, too. You know, I'm a firm believer in the power of congestion pricing. Boston is the only of the top 10 U.S. metros that does not use some form of congestion pricing to smooth out commutes for drivers.
So let that soak in, listeners, that little piece of information there. And I'm going to turn to callers. I'm going to take two or three and kind of rapid fire to give us some thoughts. So Paul from Chelmsford, go ahead.
Hi, yes, I'm calling about the funding issue for the MBTA and what the city council president was saying. Essentially, she was saying that funding would have to come from state revenue. I live outside 495. I get to use the MBTA maybe twice a year when I go in on a weekend, and that's it. So, you know, why should I be paying to fund the MBTA? And by the way, there's a lot of poor people in the rest of the state that can't really afford more taxes.
Paul from Chelmsford, thanks for that call. Let's add on Steve from Waltham. Steve, what's on your mind?
Yeah, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. If the companies are going to essentially require their employees to use the MBTA to get to work, then the company should really be hoping to subsidize this more than, let's say, that the last caller or somebody like myself who basically registers a vehicle, pays a lot of over-the-road use fees, but doesn't, you know, and I end up subsidizing the MBTA, which I don't really use, which means I'm subsidizing these employees' ability to get their employers to work.
Okay, interesting point. Steve, I'm going to move in now to Tim from the Seaport, because we move closer into the city, we're getting some, or further out, depending on how you look at it, we're getting some different perspectives. So, Tim, add on there.
Hi. Well, I just want to mention, in terms of attracting workers to Boston, I have a skill set that must be pretty attractive, because I get almost daily calls from recruiters. And my first question to them always is, where's the job? And if they say it's in Boston, I say, thanks, but no thanks. I want out of having to deal with the T every day, because it's just so frustrating.
Okay, Carolyn, that cannot be music to your ears.
No, it's not what you want to hear. And I think it starts to... It's good to hear those things, though, because it's the warning signals that we need. And we have to address these problems while they're warning signals and before they're the disaster.
Okay, so we're going to start shifting towards the end. There's so many questions that I want to ask you, but I do think we should look forward a little bit. So first, barring massive new investment, we both heard some concern from callers about where that money would come from, and we've been in a bit of a gridlock on investment in transportation for a while now. What are short-term goals for the MBTA that you think need to happen, you'd like to see happen under our current circumstances, CA?
Great. A couple of simple things. We need to do more bus rapid transit on our city streets. We need to enable buses to move. We need to use bus fast lanes and, well, we need to pilot congestion pricing, right?
Okay.
I like to call it road fares and peak road fares, right?
Explain to our listeners, what does that mean?
Well, we all pay a fare to get on transit. We need to pay a fare to use our roads as well. All of these require maintenance and upkeep.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we know the current plan for repairing the MBTA, getting to a state of good repair, is on a 13-year path right now.
Does that make you feel a little
Some
frantic?
Some listeners probably will be retired and not using the system, right, by
Fair
the time
enough.
That happens. 13 years is unacceptable.
Okay.
So we need to expedite change. We need to put money into the system, and we need to pick up the pace.
All right. So CA still said more money in the system, despite I said we don't have any more revenues.
And
so.
I would just argue we're not getting warning signs. I mean, this is a state of crisis.
So this is not,
we're past
this
the
is not future
signs.
Warning signs. We're there now. Carolyn, what are we going to do about new revenue? I mean, businesses have had a complicated relationship in Massachusetts with ways to raise new revenues. So how do we put more money into a T when there is so much tetchiness around taxes, the millionaire tax, other forms of revenue?
Well, I think the reason you see some of the sort of touchiness around it is there's not a ton of confidence in the T right now. And so
is that why your organization worked against the millionaire tax, because you weren't sure the money would be spent wisely by the T?
No, it was not just the T. There's actually quite a few reasons separate from the spending side of the money having to do with the source, as it's an unreliable source of revenue. And it's subject to the economic cycles that, in terms of the revenue, will decrease at the very time you need additional revenue for a safety net and other things. So we have a whole letter on our website laying out some of our objections to the millionaire's tax. So I kind of
distracted you there. Let me help you back to where will we get new revenue? What should we do?
You know, I talked a little bit about thinking about our revenues in terms of ways to influence behavior. So that doesn't even necessarily have to mean new revenue. It's incentivizing the things we want and making the things you want to discourage more expensive and less attractive for people.
Fantastic. C.A. Webb is president of the Kendall Square Association. C.A., thanks for coming into Radio Boston today. And Carolyn Ryan, Senior Vice President of Policy and Research at the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce, thank you as well. I enjoyed speaking with both of you. Thanks for being on Radio Boston today.
Thank you.
All right, that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderek, and Paris Alston. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. And I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.